says that poetry has to be boring or that poetry can't be practical? About 10 years ago, I discovered the poet laureate, Billy Collins. And it's amazing how many of his lines get me through a difficult day. When I read an email that I could only label digital rubbish, I think of his line that the mind can be trained to relieve itself on paper. When I find my own mind daydreaming, wandering, my sensate inner sense not focusing on what's ahead, fearing that I have wasted productive hours, I remember his couplet, "While the novelist is banging away on the typewriter, the poet is staring at a fly in a window pane." And when the news, our daily dose of news, continues to show bloodshed after bloodshed, violence after violence, I remember his stanza. I sometimes even pray it. "Nationalism is a type of insanity in which the boundaries of a land replace God." Yes, poetry can be practical. But Collins doesn't begin with such strong lines as I've just delivered. He likes to invite people into his poems. He says it should be a sort of social engagement. And he said, "I want to establish a kind of sociability or even hospitality at the beginning of a poem. The title and the first few lines are a kind of welcome mat, inviting the reader inside." Makes sense. Otherwise, who would read the poem? But there's a stark contrast between his hospitable engagement and the first reading we heard today from Kings. The prophet is not exactly hospitable when he enters the town of Zarephath. So he walks in and he sees a woman gathering sticks. Now, why is a woman gathering sticks? She's not collecting them. She's not making handicrafts. She's collecting them for a fire so that she can cook her food. And he comes in and he doesn't say, "Hi, I'm Elijah. What's your name? How are you? How are you feeling today?" The first thing he demands of her is a glass of water. She immediately runs to get the water. And as she's running to get the water, he then says to her, "Oh, and please bring me some bread." Now, she could have thought to herself, "Couldn't you have found the well yourself?" But she didn't. She says to him, "Well, God is my witness, I haven't baked the bread yet." Duh, that's why I'm gathering the sticks, to build the fire to bake the bread. His response is equally demanding. When she says to him, "Well, I will go bake the bread. I have only a little flour. I only have a little jug of oil. Give me time to break the bread." He says, "Yes, go do what you have to do. But first, bring me a small cake of bread." Now, we would say, "Well, why don't you go bake it yourself, stranger?" Or the cynic in us would probably say, "You're a prophet. Prophesy which of these houses have already baked bread and go ask it from them." But she doesn't. Now, it's important to hear the full response of the prophet to the widow in this dialogue, which we would label very rude and not hospitable. He says to her, "Do not be afraid." You know, this connects the two of them quite beautifully. Why would she be scared? Well, she's scared because she lives a hand-to-mouth existence. They've had a 3-year drought where she's wondering, is there going to be water and is there going to be food? And as a widow, she doesn't have a husband to protect her and her son. Why would he be afraid? Well, he's out of his jurisdiction, out of his territory. He's particularly vulnerable as a prophet. He has to rely on the hospitality of others for his very livelihood. So they both have reason to be afraid. And yet, by his articulation, "Do not be afraid," they both hear the voice of God. He hears God saying to them, "Don't let your life be dictated by fear. Let it be dictated by hope and trust." And consequently, he receives the sustenance he needs. She receives the faith she needs. And we see that in the end, her flour never ran empty and her jug never ran dry. All things are possible with God. I love her because she helps us understand the widow in Mark's gospel. The danger with the story of the widow's mite and the widow's gospel is we all know it. We know it so well that we probably have met people whom we've said, oh, she's the widow's mite. She's the widow's mite. And we let these fixate in our minds, and then when we hear it and go, yeah, let me think, what am I doing this afternoon? Who am I having coffee with? Who am I having brunch with? I already know this gospel. I know what they're going to say. No, we need her because we need to hear this message anew. What connects the two? These widows are what I would call fearless. They're fearless because they will do whatever God asks, even put it all out on the line. They'll give up everything for their faith. When we think of the word fearless, what are some of our synonyms? Our synonyms for fearless are invincible, muscular, take no prisoners, dominant, authoritative, type A personality, supremacy. Any of those words fit these widows? No. No. Because they have a fearlessness inside of them that puts us all to shame. I first encountered this level of fearlessness soon after I was ordained. The Jesuits sent me to work with Sudanese refugees fleeing the civil war in Sudan. And there were refugee camps that covered about a 100-kilometer radius. And one of the fun things they did was so that I could reach the refugee camps, they gave me a motorbike. It was only 125 cc's, but I loved it. At the age of 33, I felt that I had discovered a big wheel with a kickstart and a clutch. And I loved going from camp to camp. But as I would go, while it was a joy to bring the sacramental ministry, everywhere I went, every person I encountered would say, Father, can you buy shoes for my children? Father, could you pay school fees for my children? Father, could you help us buy a meal for Christmas? Father, could you help me buy medicine for my ailing mother, my ailing sister, my ailing father? Everyone, consistently, every day. And any request was worthy of a response. And yet with 150,000 refugees, there was no way for me to respond. And I remember about 3 months into the ministry, I went to visit a Comboni missionary. The Comboni missionary started in Verona, Italy. And unlike Jesuits who kind of go from place to place and leave when we think we're no longer needed, Combonis go, bring the gospel, and they die. They're buried next to the people they bring into the faith. So I really admired them. And so I'm sitting this with a Comboni missionary. Partially I liked that they had made their own cheese and they had grown their own grapes, so they made their own wine. So I said, oh, I'll get a little taste of that food. And midway through the conversation, he said, how are you finding the Sudanese? And I said, well, they're wonderful people. And then he said, are they asking you for anything? And I was like, oh, are they asking me for anything? That's all they do is ask and ask and ask, and I can't give anything, and I feel so helpless. He got quiet. He said, you're from the U.S., correct? I said, yeah. And he said, you know, I'll bet when you were a kid, you only asked for something that you had a 60 to 70% chance of getting. And I'm thinking, yeah, when I asked for a big wheel, I didn't get it, but my brother did, and I knew the odds were good. He said, you come from a place where you dare not ask until your ducks are lined up, your case is made, and you have an assurance. So these people, they don't expect anything. They don't think you're going to give what they ask for, but there's a freedom and a trust and a fearlessness in asking. And then he said to me, if they're that free to ask this of you, how free are they with God? Are you free to ask God for even the impossible? Are you free to put it all on the line? When we think of the fearlessness of the widow with the prophet Elijah, and the widow whose mite was more than any of the benefactors, we have to ask ourselves, do we have that same fearlessness? Do we have that same faith? I'm sure all of us have either hired someone or applied for a job. And when we know when you're applying for a job or hiring for someone, there are two categories. There's qualities and candidate specifications. And qualities are the degree, past experience, language proficiency, etc. And then the candidate specifications are the type of person we want. It's more the soft side, the subjective side. When we think of the qualities and the candidate specifications for a disciple of Christ, well, we know what many of the qualities are. But when you think of the type of person, can you think of any better hire than the two widows we met today? Let us aspire then to their model of discipleship. Let us be fearless witnesses to the gospel.